Welcome to the C-Suite podcast that we're recording at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. I'm Russell Goldsmith, and together with Graham Barrett, we'll be chatting to a number of the speakers and attendees from the conference.
We're producing the show in partnership with Remote, the global HR platform, and we'll be recording the conversations on their booth here in the Creative Industries Expo. Really hope you enjoy this episode. I'm here now with Sandy Carter, who is the COO of Unstoppable Domain. Sandy, very nice to see you here at South by Southwest.
So great to be here in this beautiful South by South weather and here on your show.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Now, your session was yesterday, wasn't it? And it explored a post-AI world of work. Fascinating stuff. Give us a brief overview of that session, if you don't mind, and maybe some of the key takeaways.
Yeah, so the session was great. It was sold out. Wow. It sold out on my book, so I was on top of the world. The key takeaways that I did for this session was, first, to be an AI thinker, which just means to always think AI first, like imagine what it might be like. So let's imagine that, you know, a robot, a humanoid robot, not like a little box car, but an actual humanoid robot came to deliver a pizza to you. You paid in crypto, and then you invited the robot in to set your table and pour your drinks, and then obviously do your dishes. Nobody wants to do the dishes, right? Just think about, that's all AI, right, with robots. Think about the impacts of on your brand of that, right? When the robot's pouring you the drink, do they select the drink or did you select the drink? And who does Pepsi and Coke now market to? Or even when you're doing the dishes and you've got that detergent from P&G, was that selected by the robot, the robot's company, the learning model? So there's just a whole set of interesting things when you think AI first. The second thing we talked about is business disruption and how that's going to be coming from everywhere. So we talked about things like multimodal learning models, where you're now having all the senses, not just text, but your, you know, the sight, the sound, the touch, the smell. You have all of that now coming into a learning model, which is super cool. We also talked about the collision today of AI and blockchain and how that's changing digital property rights. We talked a little bit about the emergence of spatial computing. So it was just, it was a great session, lots of different topics. And the kind of the end takeaway I gave everybody is stop resisting and go out there and play with it, right? We used to say go brainstorm it, but now we're going to say go playstorm it so you can get your hands dirty.
Yeah. Now, what I love is all these kind of examples you give, like the humanoid delivering your pizza. Can you share a few more of those?
Yeah. So another one, and this one, all of these are, there's startups already in place doing these things. One of them is a jacket, and it's for the manufacturing floor. There are a couple of companies in Asia that are testing this out right now. Mm-hmm. The jacket has sensors in it. So if you ever had like a mood ring, I don't know if you ever had a mood ring, this is a mood jacket. Mm-hmm. So it has sensors on. So, you know, imagine behind the dashboard, AI is hard at work analyzing, okay, well, maybe Sandy needs a break after an hour, not 2 hours, or maybe, you know, you can go on for 3 hours, or it senses a temperature. I'm too hot, so maybe in my area, I can get more fans. But imagine the impacts now. If you're the manager of those factory floor workers, you now have to explain privacy of the data. Why are they collecting this individualized data? Why is it good for you? What's going to be done with the data? What about just implications overall for, you know, the clothes that you buy? Now, are you going to be buying new jackets? So that might impact the retail industry. There's just so many questions.
So many implications, aren't there? You know, just so many knock-on effects. And, you know, particularly with that jacket, you know, does my boss need to know if I may be in a bad mood one day or if I'm not feeling up to it? Because surely if I'm doing my job, that might be enough. But yeah, it's all these knock-on effects, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's fascinating because there are positive things to it, hashtag tech for good, but there's also then, you know, what happens with privacy? We talked about, is there privacy as we go forward in the future? Another one we talked about is a digital identity. You know, I'm from Unstoppable, so we do digital identities. So imagine, you know, right now you can have a digital identity. You can have your car title in that or your diploma. And this is quite interesting. So LinkedIn published an article that said that 36% of things on LinkedIn, like education, are incorrect.
Wow.
That's a third. But now if you have a digital identity built on the blockchain, what you have is something that's verified and credentialed. So it's a soulbound token. So I can't go to Stanford, transfer my degree to you. So it really changes the game. But now if you apply AI to it with that convergence, now you could have AI looking to say, wow, Sandy's got a South by Southwest badge in her digital identity. Maybe she wants to take some education in, you know, maybe at Arizona State University. Or maybe I have, you know, that I own an apartment in Austin. So maybe I need to know about all the get-togethers and events that are near my apartment. So you could imagine that AI could step in there and make a ton of recommendations for you. And then again, implications. How are those recommendations done? Is somebody inputting into the learning large language model, or is it, you know, by proximity? And then the final one is, you know, in the blockchain world, that data belongs to you. So could you imagine passive income coming in by your from your data? For instance, you know, people already are giving, you know, selfies, first in line for a selfie, or, you know, discounts off tickets or T-shirts or bags by having something in your digital identity. What if you could monetize that as well? So there's so many questions here about where we could go in the future, especially with the convergence of all these different technologies together.
How do you think people will react to that? Do you think, is there initially, I suppose we're all a little bit scared of the unknown, aren't we? So there might be some resistance, but then as we get used to it, it'll just become part of our daily lives? Is that what you anticipate?
I think so. In the session that I did as well, we did talk about the new challenges that AI brings to the table, right? Like, can I trust what I see, right? Is it a deep fake? Is AI hallucinating? You know, my daughter's taking a prompting class, and she was looking for some sources that backed up one of her theories. And so she asked ChatGPT, and of the five sources it gave, three of them weren't real. Even though it gave a book title, an author, and a page in the book where this was supported, it actually wasn't real.
That's crazy.
It is crazy, right? So there are challenges that you have to work through. Data, right? If you don't have enough data. So this example, I love and I hate it at the same time. But McKinsey did some research on the lack of women's data in healthcare. I did not know in the U.S. it wasn't mandatory to include women in clinical studies until 1993.
Really?
Which means you have this huge gap in data.
Yeah, of course.
So one AI startup started had this amazing liver disease detector. You just had to take blood from your arm and it would detect with 77% accuracy if you had liver cancer or liver disease, except for women. Only 33% accurate for women. Why? Because if you look at the data, all the data that was used was male-based data. And so these are all the challenges that we have to get through to get to all those really cool stories to happen and happen in the right way. And it is why, you know, I love things that are starting up like responsible AI, that sort of thing.
We'll just finish up. I mean, those are fascinating. And yet again, the knock-on effects of all those things are incredible. But just finish up by talking a little bit about Unstoppable. So all of these amazing insights that you are sharing here with us today and at your talk, how do they inform company culture maybe at Unstoppable?
Well, first of all, there's a couple of exciting things. So Unstoppable does that digital identity. We have 4 million digital identities out there today. And so you can see as we're looking at the future, like what AI analysis can you do? We already provide AI avatars that you can use or leverage. We're also already using it to build community, which builds trust. Trust is one of the number one gaps that are in our society today. So actually this morning, you guys are getting the scoop. This morning we announced Dot Austin, which is a digital identity for businesses, companies, individuals in Austin. And it's really meant to enthrall some of that trust back in. So you can talk to your, you know, let's say that you belong to the Greater Austin Asian Chamber of Commerce. Now you can share what your thoughts are about, you know, what they're doing, what programs they have, what else they need. So I think that's pretty pretty phenomenal.
That's pretty cool,
And then, you know, if you think about it, all of this stuff is going to blend together. But one of the big things are deep fakes. 49% of the world's population will go through an election this year. 49%.
US, and, UK,
EU, Asia, I mean, you name it. And so one of the big things are deep fakes. So it, you can actually do trust verification with a domain to identify if that picture, that quote, whatever, was actually from you with like a verified check.
Yeah, yeah.
So for example, you know, the Pope's picture in the Bauman jacket that turned out to be incorrect.
Yeah.
Would not have a check mark on it, but maybe me and my puffer jacket on what Monday or Sunday when it was so cold here would be a true picture.
Okay.
Now you can verify that with that unstoppable digital identity.
Yeah.
So all of this is invading the products we bring to market, how we think about things. Again, we're trying to be AI first thinkers as well.
Okay. Well, listen, we love breaking news on the podcast. So thanks very much for sharing that with us. Sandy Carter, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, I'm here with Sabrina Sullivan. She is the Foresight Fellow at the Ford Motor Company. Nice to see you here, Sabrina.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, as I mentioned, you are the Foresight Fellow at the Ford Motor Company. In such a rapidly changing world, how do you go about predicting future trends?
The prediction is the hardest thing because technically we're not predicting something. But I do like the use of predicting futures because I'm predicting based off of what we know today, some plausible futures. So the first basic thing is we have to actually predict or model out several different futures, not one, which is typical to many folks when they're doing strategic planning. But this involves everything from constant horizon scanning of the weak to the strong signals, nailing down what are those trends, which like trends does not mean trendy. I'm not talking about the flare jeans or the move to more 90s baggy fashion, which sends me into PTSD thinking about my childhood. But then you start to push to scenarios and you start to work with groups. And the biggest thing is it needs to be more than just intelligence. You have to ground it in strategic priorities and start to figure out how do you action on it, which is often the hardest part of dealing with the future.
No, absolutely. Now, you spoke here at South by Southwest on a sold out session, didn't you, about the future
of
leadership?
Right.
How did that go?
It went fabulously. There are a couple things that it showed me. There are a number of people who are questioning whether the leadership playbooks of the past or even today are at all relevant or compatible. And I think my sort of thesis is that leadership as we know it is dead, because many of the large books that people will point to as like, this is my leadership mantra, or like, you know, Stephen Covey, those sort of folks, those are from very different times. Even back to like some people cite some from the 1920s where like sliced bread had just hit the market or before we even had smartphones. And so in this world, we have to start to navigate that. And our session was really predicated on, we don't know what the future of leadership is, so you have to create it. And we brought together my area of expertise with foresight and pushing people to the future and what does this complex world look like, with an industrial organizational psychologist who says these are ways that you as leaders could start to show up.
Yeah. Well, how are we doing as leaders generally then across the corporate world? Are we doing good by Gen Z, or are we failing that generation, would you say?
I like to hold people capable, and the challenge is I don't think we've equipped the leaders to understand the next generations. And Gen Z, it's the hot topic now, but if we talk Gen Alpha, we haven't modulated. So I think that time for pause and to connect with those Gen Z leaders, we need to do that, because the more we talk to Gen Z individuals as well, they don't see leadership as a path for them, which is scary when we think there's a number of leaders stepping out of the working world because of retirement or otherwise. And then we're hoping that Gen Z will come in, but they're looking at leadership as it is today, which involves a lot of burnout, challenges to well-being, again, facing all of these complex social technological issues. And they're like, in some cases, they're like, I'm out.
Yeah.
Or they're looking for a new way to tackle some big problems that they're saying, I need purpose to this. So there's a number of different things that we have to start to think about and connect with a different set of values.
Okay. Is some of it about a structure of the workplace? Maybe that obviously that's been set up in a way that we're all quite familiar with. If Gen Z aren't maybe happy with that structure, then that has implications for the leadership as well.
Yeah, I think it's a very sort of like me-centric or individual-centric to say like this is the one way to do things. And I think with Gen Z, the more that we understand really the potential, this is going to be the most diverse group that we've ever seen come into to the workforce. We have to start to think differently of how we structure it. And it's not just saying they only want to work remotely. That's kind of what they were brought up into. There's even different ways that I've read a number of Gen Z folks looking to actually return to cubicles. And I'm not saying let's throw cubicle farms back in the mix, but that it's the cubicle was used as a way to sort of recharge and disconnect, as like social interaction can be draining. And we all know social interaction can be a little bit draining. Yeah. It's that oscillation between being on all the time versus being able to regenerate.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things there I'd like to pick up on, but certainly the remote working side of things. I mean, how do you see that progressing? I mean, we can't row back from that now, can we? And as you said, Gen Z are comfortable working at home, or they're used to working at home. So how do you see that changing, adapting as we go forward?
Yeah, I think it becomes a part of the ingredients that you have to consider. And I know we all want to talk about everyone rolling back remote work policies. It's not going to happen. No. It's how are you going to start to lead through that? And I think it's questions that I ask myself as a team leader of like, how do I need to adjust? Because I grew up in a situation where I showed up in the office, so that's what I know, but how do we start to experiment a little bit more? So it's not to shy away from it. And to me, it's always been an opportunity. The only reason I got to work directly with Ford World Headquarters as a Canadian was because we went remote. Right. So it challenged those policies. And to me, it was like, oh, you can start to tap global talent and engage them. And then when I do come in person, it's very purposeful, deep work that we're doing. And it's not me showing up to sit in an office on Zoom calls with other people. That just seems, I don't know how anyone thinks that that's common sense.
Yeah, yeah. And just finish up with just some maybe of your insights into leadership. You've given us a few already, but I know you talk about leading with innovation and vision. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
I think with that, it's in a lot of cases, innovation and vision. I'll take vision first. Vision is 5+ years out. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about transformative visions, we're not talking about the operational plan for the next 12 months. Yeah. That doesn't ground me in some sort of North Star. And because that is rife with uncertainty as you set out a vision, it means you can actually unlock some of the creativity of your team because you're saying there are multiple different ways that we can start to tackle it versus me telling an overly prescriptive plan. With innovation, it's actually saying what are the orthodoxies that we're going to start to challenge. And I believe orthodoxies, which are the norms, the assumptions that we hold true, it's like this is the way it's always been. Yep. Those are the areas ripe for innovation. So when I'm pushing people, I'm saying even just at that basic level, setting out that longer term vision and challenging the orthodoxies that are right in front of you, because that's where you can start.
Okay. Wow, it's fascinating stuff. I'm so glad your talk went well here at South by Southwest.
It was very exciting.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
To be sold out, that is exciting.
It was sold out. There was
good feedback as well from the floor.
Great feedback, and people are continuing to engage, and you feel like a little bit of a fan moment. But I'm just glad that I could help people.
Yeah. Well, Sabrina Sullivan, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Thanks for having me.
No worries at all.
So I'm now joined by Janice Amadeke, Exited Tech CEO and author of Mentorship Unlocked, which we'll come on to talk about very shortly. But Janice, first of all, thanks so much for taking some time to join us. I know you've been speaking about mentorship here at South By.
Yes.
Why are you so passionate about this topic?
Mentorship is something that helps people evolve in their careers in one of the most impactful ways possible. You can get promoted 5 times faster as a mentee, 6 times faster as a mentor, and that collaboration between innovation and vulnerability is where you see real change inside large companies. So that's been a big passion of mine. I had an entire tech startup called The Mentor Method, focused on mentorship and creating fulfilling careers. And now with my book, Mentorship Unlocked, The Science Art of Setting Yourself Up for Success, I'm flipping it on its head and making mentorship a one-to-one relationship between myself and the reader to help them build even more fulfilling careers.
Great. So it sounds like you're the right person to ask this question. How do you go about finding the right mentor?
First, practice a high level of self-awareness. Understanding who you are, what makes you unique, and what you want out of a mentor will help you filter out who's actually a fit and who isn't, and you save time in building those relationships versus spinning your wheels and practicing a spray and pray approach of just wanting a mentor by title without actually knowing how you're going to interact with them.
How do you bring that into company culture, and you know, how does it shape the company culture and values?
Mentorship is a phenomenal way for corporations to increase their retention and development of their talent, whether they're in the C-suite or entry-level new hire. Mentorship helps build those sustainable relationships inside the organization. You get this magical knowledge transfer between either senior leadership to new hires or less tenured employees, or if you're in reverse mentorship, then the opposite of that, where more senior level talent can learn maybe new technologies or new approaches to solving the same problems. And so I think mentorship is a great way to build generational bridges. This is the first time in our lives where we have five generations of professionals inside some of the same organizations. So how are you making sure that everybody is collaborating and that you're still focused on innovation, increasing the bottom line, and making sure that everybody inside the company feels seen, heard, and respected? And mentorship is a great way to do that. And it's free. I mean, it doesn't cost a lot of time. It's just a matter of investing in your employees and making sure that they have a vulnerable space and the framework to build those relationships.
If the company doesn't offer that, what's your advice to the employees to kind of push for it if they really want that?
Well, at this day and age, companies don't really have an excuse to not provide leadership development courses and training. If it's a matter of budget, purchasing copies of Mentorship Unlocked is a great way to do that. We've seen that with companies including Visa and others purchasing copies of our book in order to help their employees get the framework and understanding of what mentorship is, the types of mentors that they need, because we go through the seven types of mentors every professional needs in their career, how to find them, how to communicate with them, the pros and cons of each, and then following a framework and how to actually build those relationships, structure meetings, and everything. So if your head of talent management is just strapped right now for time, as a lot of companies are, as they're looking over their shoulders for layoffs and other things, it's a great way to build that autonomous, choice-driven mentorship inside the organization.
Are there any additional challenges that have come about now that we're, you know, in this kind of hybrid and remote working world?
No, I actually think that it's expanded the opportunities to connect, because you're no longer forced to kind of stand by the water cooler and hope that you meet your mentor. You have LinkedIn, you have social media, you have these virtual communities, and the world has really opened up so that you're not just regionally focused on who your mentor is, but now globally. And I've had mentors from all over the world that I've only met over Zoom, and I'm hoping to meet sometime this year, ideally, depending on my speaking engagement schedule. But they've been some of the most incredible and most impactful leaders that I've ever met. And had I had this singular sort of smaller lens on, they have to be based in Austin, Texas, where I am, in order for me to work with them, I would have never met them.
Great. Now, you've touched on your book a couple of times, so
yes,
I feel obliged to give you a plug here, because I've got a copy with us, which you've very kindly left here for us.
Yes, I hope you like it.
No, well, tell us about it. How did this come about? How did you end up writing this book?
Yeah, so I'm first-generation American. My parents immigrated from the Congo in the 70s through college scholarships from missionaries. And so from a very young age, I saw them serve as mentors for our community with other people that were immigrating to the States. Our guest bedroom was always full with either a family or friends. And I saw them go through great lengths and this very specific attention to detail around how to get acclimated to American life, to a way where I was like, why are we going into this granularity? But now at 36, and just sort of, you know, that reflecting you do as an adult, I realized that they were taking that attention to detail and very systematically helping people get acclimated, because they didn't have that when they first immigrated. And so when Wiley approached me with the opportunity to write a book on mentorship, I wanted to play a part in as many people's career development as possible. And I used their example of granularity, very specific details, cutting out the fluff, giving people exactly what they need to be successful, and following that process in Mentorship Unlocked.
Great.
I'm very proud of it and excited.
Pre-orders out yet?
Pre-orders are out, yes. You can find copies Amazon, Target, Barnes & Noble, Book People, Independent Sellers, but then also JaniceOmadecki.com with all of the book information.
Amazing. We'll put the links on our show notes. But for now, Janice Omadecki, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Joining me now is Dan Cullen-Shute. He is the worldwide CEO and founder of Creature. Dan, lovely to see you.
A pleasure to be here.
Yeah.
Pleasure to be here. Forgive me, it's been an intense 4 days, so if I'm slightly dusty, then blame South By.
But not at all, no, you're not dusty at all. But I really want to hear about this talk that you gave, because it sounds fascinating. All about ensuring companies pay their staff properly, right?
It was indeed. It was an amazing thing. I think we sort of submitted a couple of ideas for talks. I work in the advertising industry. The talk was called Peace, Love and Positive Coercion.
Okay.
Making companies happy to pay people properly. And it was honestly the one I thought would interest people less. It's hard when you're in something, right? And you don't necessarily see it. But it was picked up, it was accepted. We're part of the workplace stream, which was interesting for me as well. Like, I've been here before, but only ever in the ad marketing type world. So kind of branch out was really fun. It's a sort of speaking to something that I've been doing alongside my I guess, day job for the last 13 years, which is we have a mission at Creature, which is the agency that I already mentioned, which is to leave the industry better than we found it, which means we can't just do good stuff ourselves. We have to do good stuff in a way that makes other people want to do it. And positive coercion is right at the heart of that.
Okay.
It's forcing folk to do things they might not necessarily want to do.
Right.
But in a way that makes them really glad that they did and forget that they originally didn't.
So where's this come from then? Why are you so passionate about this issue?
I think I'm one of those people who, you know, I probably didn't realize the privilege I'd experienced until I spotted that it wasn't everywhere, if you know what I mean. You know, I grew up in Wales. Wales is a funny place. Like, I had a very privileged upbringing from a Welsh point of view, but I played a lot of rugby, and, you know, we'd travel east to play English schools, and we would... forgive me, because I haven't asked whether I'm allowed to swear or not.
Go for it.
Fantastic. We'd get the shit kicked out of us for being, you know, Welsh lads. But then I'd travel west into Wales, and we'd get the shit kicked out of us for being posh Welshies.
So you had it both sides. Yeah.
Exactly. So wherever we went, we got the shit kicked out of us. Which I've always been very sort of conscious of that and the world that we live in. And then at Creature, we, you know, there were things we did well, and there were things we did less well. And one of the things we did less well was paying our creative placements back in the day. We realized that wasn't just us, that was a systemic industry thing. And because we're annoying, we wanted to change that everywhere, not just in our house.
Yeah, so this is all about a living wage, isn't it?
It is.
London's a, you know, a great example, obviously, because it's so expensive to live there. But
yeah.
what's it all about? What does it actually mean?
Well, it's two things, and it sounds really pedantic, but it's a real living wage, not a living wage.
Right.
and that's entirely because the government co-opted, so this is the UK government, co-opted the language of living wage about decade ago. George Osborne literally rebranded the minimum wage as living wage because it sounded better.
Yeah.
Which meant that the Living Wage Foundation, who we work with a lot, who are an independent body funded by donations and charitable support, who work with partners to set both a London real living wage and an outside of London real living wage, because there is still that London madness.
Yeah.
They had to add the word real in to make it clear that there was still a difference. But it came from a moment where we realized that we weren't paying people enough to work and live, is the sort of the brutal answer to it. And when you're trying to be good as well as successful, that's a horrible thing to realize. We worked very hard. Obviously, I mean, we changed it immediately internally, but we looked around and everyone else was still doing the same thing. And there's, some might argue, a foolish choice there. You can retain that as a competitive advantage and thrive when everyone else is being an asshole, or you can step outside and try and make things better for more people. And I think, you know, we, back of a fag packet maths, but we think we've made lives better for tens of thousands of people over the last 10 years.
And I've seen some of your posts on social media. You're quite keen to call out the companies who are doing this well and who are setting up themselves as a real living wage company, but also those who aren't as well. And you want to highlight those companies, yeah?
It's so important. And I would always rather focus on the people who are doing it well. I think that's at the heart of positive coercion, is making people feel left out of the gang that's being elevated rather than pointing a finger.
Yeah.
You tell someone they're doing something bad, they feel bad, they don't necessarily do anything about it. You tell someone that they could be part of a group that's being celebrated for doing something brilliantly, and they desperately want to be a part of that. We talk about the hyperbole of a mission. Basically, sometimes the logos that aren't on a page speak much louder than the logos that are, and that's at the heart of positive coercion. It's, you know, you're over there doing a bad thing, and that's on you, but if you want to come over here and be part of the group that's getting this right, everyone's going to think it wonderful. And that's, we've found, that is so much more compelling and so much more persuasive than finger wagging and criticizing.
So if you want to be part of that group, obviously you can just go about paying your staff more. But
would
how do you
start.
Get? Yeah, that would be a good start. But do you need to be accredited as well to prove that you are a company that does that?
Yeah, so that's at the heart of it. The Living Wage Foundation in the UK and Living Wage for us, stroke US in the US. These are businesses that ask you to jump over a very small number of hurdles to demonstrate that you pay your staff properly. But it's not just your staff, importantly, it's the other people that support the business. So the cleaners that come in the middle of the night, the security staff that are there from 6 o'clock, making sure that all of those contracts are set up so that those people are being paid a living wage as well. And if you're already doing it, phenomenal. Get the accreditation, because the Living Wage Foundation is supremely important in terms of holding people to account, in terms of making sure this actually happens. And they, by very definition, are not government funded. They are fully independent, and they need the support, they need the help. And it's impossible, I think, to stress enough how big a difference it makes to the lives of people who aren't currently being paid enough. Yeah. And you know, this isn't grads who are only getting a 25 grand starting salary. This is cleaners who are on £7 an hour. This is security staff who are on seven, and it's not okay.
No, absolutely not. Now, how does this extend to Creature? Talk to me a bit about maybe the company culture that you're trying to foster there, because obviously you're trying to do the right thing in terms of paying your staff properly, but how does that infiltrate into the culture as well?
We always said with Creature that we you know, you want to be a great agency. That's nobody sets up a business to be average. Mm. But as well as being great, we also wanted to be good. Mm. And that's good with a capital G in a massively worthy, self-righteous, occasionally overbearing kind of way. But I think it's like I said, we want to leave the industry better than we found it. Advertising is I have a complicated relationship with the industry that I've somehow spent the last 20 years working in. It's not always brilliant. It's not always a thing to be proud of. Again, it's going to sound glib, but I have two young kids, and at some point, I assume they will go through that incredibly self-righteous period that every teenager goes through, and they will look at me and go, advertising, that's awful. You're a capitalist monster.
Yeah.
And I really want to be able to point at things that we've done and go, yes, I sold a lot of shoes, but all of these things are different, and all of these things are better. And it comes back to privilege again, right? Like, I have worked very hard, but I know that I worked very hard from a more privileged place than a lot of people who work very hard. I don't want ever to take that for granted. I don't ever want to be able to look at what I've done and go, oh. And honestly, I think Creature would be a lot more successful, and we'd all be significantly richer if we didn't care as much about this stuff. But you know,
sometimes you got to do the right thing.
Well, you only get one life, right? And I don't want to look back at this and go, yeah, I'm rich, but I'm an arsehole. I want to know that we tried, that we pushed, that we worked, and that we've made an impact alongside all of the, you know, advertising is brilliant in a lot of ways. We help businesses do better, which helps the economy be better, which funds public services, which does all, and we get to be really silly at the same time and talk about seagull puppets and other stuff. But we also have an opportunity to change things. And, you know, there comes a moment in every day where you can either switch off the webcam and go and watch the telly, or you can put a bit of effort into making things better. And I hope I can always be that guy.
Yeah. Well, that's brilliant. I think that's a great way to conclude our conversation here.
Thank you.
Dan Cullen-Shute, thanks so much for joining me.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
I'm here with Jeffrey Edel, who is the CEO and chairman of MeWe. Welcome to South by Southwest, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Graham. Happy to be here.
Start by giving me an introduction to MeWe, if you don't mind, and what you're trying to achieve.
Sure. MeWe is a social media platform. Everybody is tired of a lot of social media, but we're here. But we're very different than what exists today, where you have Facebook and some of these other players that, from a top line, grab your data information and use it to line their own pockets. MeWe is the opposite of that. We're a privacy-based platform, doesn't invade into your feeds. We don't amplify misinformation. And as we move to the blockchain, it'll give us a better ability to protect your privacy and allow you to take control of your data and information. It's very different than what exists today, but some of the excitement comes in our move to the blockchain. We have 700,000 groups. We have over 20 million people on platform today. And we grow organically 2,000 to 3,000 every day without doing anything. And about 5,000 people every 30 days add new groups are added, which is pretty incredible.
And there's clearly a growing appetite for a social media platform like this, you know, as can be shown by the number of people you're attracting to your platform.
Absolutely, absolutely. Look, our motto is don't give up on social media, hit refresh. That's okay. What we're trying to say.
I like that.
And we're not trying to take people necessarily off of Facebook or Twitter or Instagram and so forth. We're very Facebook, Instagram-ish like that. Mm-hmm. But we're looking for you if you want to find new groups, new friends, and new things to do on platform. Mm-hmm. And plus this new Web3 opportunities that we're going into.
Sure. Now, at South by Southwest, MeWe has been shortlisted, hasn't it, for the South by Southwest Innovation Awards. So how proud were you to be shortlisted for that award? What does that mean for the company?
No, it's great. The company actually, in 2016, won a Best New Company Award for technology, seven, 8 years ago. So it's nice to be back for this one. This one, we were shortlisted with five companies, and stiff competition. And it's a lot of innovation within social media.
Okay.
And Mark Cuban showed up to boost up his company. So we have some stiff competition there, but it's really exciting.
Yeah, well, we wish you all the best for that. But what about, go back to the blockchain, because you just mentioned that, because I'm really interested in this side of the business. So how does this migration to the blockchain enable your users to take control of their data, because that's what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah, it's controlling, exactly. The concept is that because we're a privacy-based company with no amplification, we want you to own and control your own data. Mm-hmm. And we made a very pioneering, I think, decision. We're the first app at scale to move to the blockchain. And we partnered with McCourt Global, who made an investment in MeWe, to move onto their frequency chain. And if you know blockchain at all, frequency sits on Polkadot. So we're on Polkadot.
Right.
And within the blockchain, owners, creators, and so forth can be verified that they're actually not bots, they're real people. Mm-hmm. They're gonna get themselves a handle that is utilizable throughout the blockchain, so you're gonna be able to move around. And the big feature that's coming up is controlling your own social graph. So if you're on Facebook, yeah. you have, I don't know, you probably have 50,000 people following you on Facebook. And if you want to go somewhere else, there's nothing you can do about it. You'd lose all those people.
Yeah.
But in our platform, on the blockchain, you'd be able to take your social graph and do everything from monetize it directly
okay.
to taking it with you onto other blockchain applications.
Right.
And that's very different. We have, like you alluded to earlier, we have a little over 20 million folks on platform.
Yeah.
And we've already migrated about 670,000 as of right now, to the blockchain. And it's making us, right now, we're the largest decentralized social media platform in the world, as we sit here today.
It must be an exciting place to work as well. You know, people want to get involved in a project like this, and I'm sure they're inspired by you as well. How do you attract the best talent to the business?
Well, like you say, if you have a really interesting project, people want to be a part of it. We have some amazing people that come from everywhere, from Disney, Apple, Yahoo, all working with us. This has been a long-term startup. 3 years ago, when I got to the company, we had to think about a strategy, like what we were going to do with the business. And I looked at it and thought, well, if we just go against the Facebooks and Instagrams and those folks in the world, you don't want to be, well, if you don't like Facebook, come to MeWe. If you don't like Snapchat, come to MeWe. You don't want to be having like a negative view on why you do something. So how could we compete and how could we build value for the shareholders and make it an exciting place to work for people? So actually, I read an article where Frank McCourt was investing in something called Project Liberty. At that point, he'd committed $100 million to it. Through today, he's committed $500 million to it. And I thought, well, that's the wagon I want to hitch to, because it's social media on a new social web, and it's creating it in a blockchain to benefit the world. Mm-hmm. So now I could be more than just a capitalist. I can actually try to create something that does great for the world. Because as you know, I don't know how old your kids are and things like that, but our children with social media, mentally, they're so worried about how they appear. There's mental illness going on. It becomes a problem for our kids, society, the divisiveness that exists in the politics here in this country and all around the world.
Sure.
And we tried to create a space where we could validate information on the blockchain. People are real, and we are more respectful to children and what's going on in society and the morals and ethics of the world. Yeah. So it's really important.
Yeah, sounds amazing. So we'll just finish up by telling me about your expansion plans, maybe for the next 12 months. Just give me a top line on what you're trying to achieve.
Sure. So MeWe is a freemium business. It's a free business. And what happens is people will sign up for free. They can use everything on the platform, whether they go into groups or so forth. But if they want to, and we encourage them to, they could subscribe, and then they could pay a monthly fee. Very few people do that, but they also have an I Support MeWe kind of program as well. So moving to the blockchain, we're now going to be able to avail ourselves over time with the opportunity for NFTIs in groups. So if you have a group, it's like you've created your own business. Why not create value, and you get the benefit of that value? As content creators are going to create content within the various groups as well, they'll have an ability to monetize through the use of wallets and tokens.
Yeah.
So as we move to the future, we want to tokenize the platform and create a rewards-based system with points. It's almost like gamifying social media.
Sure. look, it sounds like you've got everything in place to make a success of MeWe. We wish you all the best of luck for the business and also for these innovation awards. Jeffrey, thanks for joining me here today.
Thank you, Graham. I appreciate being here.
Thanks so much again to all our guests who took the time to chat with us on Remote's booth here at South by Southwest.
Really hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please do follow us wherever you get your podcasts, and please do give us a positive rating and review. Plus, you can find us on all the usual social channels.
And if you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can do that via the contact form on the website at csuitepodcast.com. But for now, from me, Russell Goldsmith, and Graham Barrett, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.